Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. I'm very pleased to be here representing Fidelity National Title this afternoon, but I'm going to call it Security Title because that's how it was referred to at the trial court below.
And counsel, I would just ask that you please state your name and your bar number.
Mary Wells.
Thank you.
Wells Anderson and Race, bar number 8522. We have three critical contract provisions that are at issue. Paragraph 7.2, 7.3, and 7.4. And when I say that, I don't mean to exclude the rest of section 7 of the underwriting agreement, which is exhibit number 1. There are defined terms which are important. Defined terms, namely loss, single loss, and title report. Security Title is not an underwriter. Security Title is an agent. What it does is to solicit opportunities to sell title insurance. The underwriter is First American Title Insurance Company. The underwriter has a very specific function, and that underwriter's function is to pay losses when they are presented to the company. First American and its arguments attempts to make Security into an underwriter when that clearly cannot happen under Colorado law. The contract between the parties, between two sophisticated parties, clearly sets forth the limitations of liability for each of them, limiting Security's exposure to $500 per single loss paid. First American insures the title loss, and if a title loss is paid, Security may be liable for up to $500 thereof pursuant to section 7.2.
Did you argue the $500 figure in the trial court?
The matter was raised in the trial management order, and it was raised in the Rule 59 motion. It was not part of the arguments that were made to the trial court. However, the vigorous argument that was made to the trial court is that there was no liability at all, no liability under 7.3, no liability under 7.4, and unless there is some finding of liability for a title loss, there is no exposure under 7.2. The trial court seemed to disrespect in some regards the fact that the limitation was $500. But I think that is a demonstration of a lack of understanding of the importance of the relationship between the parties. You will see in the trial court record that at times 500 closings per month were being done. Many, many, many insurance policies were being underwritten by First American, where Security Title was the agent. So that if you think about the potential exposure that is there, that $500 per loss paid is nothing insignificant. And that was a business decision agreed upon between those two sophisticated parties when they entered into the contract.
Now, Ms. Wells, I've reviewed the trial management order, and the language that is used by your predecessor counsel seems to indicate that predecessor counsel did not think the $500 limit applied to this claim if there were liability found under one of the other sections of subsections of other subsections of Section 7. Subject to specific exceptions enumerated in Section 7 of the underwriting agreement, Security Title Fidelity's share of losses is limited to $500 per claim, and then indicates that under 7.3, the liability should be limited to $295,000. So it wasn't, couldn't the trial court judge have been justified in thinking that the issue of a full $500 limitation was not raised?
I think not. I think that is not a fair way to look at the trial management order or what occurred in the trial, and especially considering the Rule 59 motion that was presented.
Well, please help me understand that.
Because the parties are entitled to make alternative arguments. And so when we look at the alternatives that were being raised in the trial court. Yes, there are alternatives that are raised there, but we must come back to the fact that we are dealing with a contract which is subject to legal interpretation of the terms therein.
Excuse me, but I'm having trouble seeing how this, if there is an alternative argument even raised in the trial management order, that the total damages are limited to $500.
Well, I think that the language relating to the $500 limitation is sufficient to raise it pre-trial, and then of course we have raised it again post-trial in the Rule 59 motion.
Assuming that we disagree potentially with you that about that there's an alternative way to read the trial management order, do you have any authority that says that until, if you raise an issue for the very first time in a post-trial motion, Rule 59 motion, that it is preserved for appeal?
Candidly, Your Honor, in a circumstance like this, there has to be raising it prior to trial and a post-trial motion. And under the authority of JW Construction, under the Fiber case and under the Flores case, we believe that we have met the requirements to preserve the issue for appeal.
I understand your position. Thank you.
If I can go to the issues related to 7.3, because when we are looking at is there liability under 7.3, the answer is no, because we know that the decision was made which gave rise to First American paying Colorado East is an underwriting decision. It was a title decision. It was made by Mr. Greg Wolf. And it is clear from the trial court that the trial court recognized that Mr. Wolf made a title decision. If we look at page 3413, the trial court said, what Mr. Wolf did was he made a title decision. When he got the phone call on the title side of the operation, he said, that will satisfy. Mr. Skillern, in his opening statement at page 2699, said Security Title elected to accept the Brown letter as full satisfaction of its own title insurance requirement in its own commitment. And what we know is that First American may have to pay a loss under a title report. And it is the underwriting activity which creates a title report. It is the underwriting and title side of the business that creates the title commitment. And it is, of course, that side of the business that creates the policy which gave rise to a claim being made here.
Is the loss that was suffered here an underwriting loss?
Yes, it is. It is, that is what they paid. A claim was presented.
Does a loss arise out of an underwriting error?
Yes.
Or does it arise out of the agent misdistributing funds entrusted to it?
It clearly arises out of an underwriting error for this reason. The underwriting error had to occur, assuming that it's an error. We're not disputing that for the purposes of this appeal. The error has to occur because otherwise the closing, of course, isn't going to take place. What we have is the underwriting decision, the title decision, whereby Mr. Wolf says, I will accept this payoff statement in satisfaction of the particular requirement.
And that was done by Security Title or an agent of Security Title.
It was done by an employee of Security Title, which is the agent. The agent issues title commitments. The agent issues title policies after a closing has taken place. If I could give you an example.
Correct me if I'm wrong. The underwriter doesn't look at anything until after everything is done.
The agent does the work for the underwriter. And you're correct, The underwriter itself, First American, does not see things in the process.
So the under, what we're calling the underwriter here is the insuring, is the party that insures the risk.
The First American is the underwriter. Its agent, Security Title, makes certain risk-taking decisions, like this one, whereby it makes a title side decision that it will accept certain documentation in support of its, well, in fulfillment of a particular requirement. There is evidence in the chart about the fact that sometimes security only provides the title commitment and later the title policy, and somebody else does the closing. In a circumstance like that, if there was an issue raised by the closing company, totally unrelated, they would call up Greg Wolf or someone else on at security to see whether security as agent for the underwriter, First American, is willing to take the risk based upon certain documentation. So it's quite clear that the event which occurs that then permits funds to be distributed at a closing is a title and risk-taking underwriting decision, if you will, made by First American's agent, Security.
And who bears the risk of that? You're saying that the risk of that is all borne by the First American.
Correct, because that is the deal that they struck. That is what this underwriting agreement requires. And that is the arrangement that they had for more than 10 years, although this contract started in 1998. So that indeed was the bargain that they had. I see that my time is about to expire. I would like to raise the issue of 7.4 as well, which there is no liability here under 7.4 either. 7.4 is a provision that merely imposes mutual obligations. The policy directs that notice be given to First American, not Security, that is the insurance policy itself. 7.4 directs that the parties must give notice to each other when they have knowledge that a claim or loss under a title report may arise. The way that First American wants to characterize this loss is not a loss under a title report, because that takes them out from under 7.3 and this handling funds in connection with any escrow or closing. And we know we've got the argument about, well, is it escrow or is it closing? But under 7.4, we're looking at simply a notice requirement that notice must be given if they have knowledge that a claim or loss under a title report may arise. That's not anything having to do with handling funds in connection with an escrow. That's a different issue. So I'd like to save a couple of moments for rebuttal, unless you have questions now.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you.
May I please report Frederick Skillern, my number 7983, Montgomery, Little and Soren, on behalf of First American Title Insurance. I will try to address a couple of points that I think are important, and I'll start with the last discussion first, not part on 7.4, but on the role of the parties and the claim now that some sort of underwriting error was made that makes the what happened at the closing, the closing process, a title issue and not an escrow and closing issue. We have never said, contrary to the allegation, that Security was acting as an underwriter. First American is the underwriter. For the purposes of issuing the title report, and for that purposes only, security is the agent of First American. There's general, almost hornbook law in the title insurance area. It's in the Fidelity title case, the Muspin case in Indiana, cited in our opening brief, where they talk about how any title agent here wears two hats. You are an agent for the underwriter in the preparation of the title report, the title commitment, in doing the title research. And it's appropriate that you may contract to have lower losses as an agent in that regard, because if you do your work carefully, there will be few losses, because we're talking about public records.
Well, the typical underwriting loss is there was some stray instrument or something that senior that's later discovered.
Correct.
And here, everybody knew about the status of this property, and it was even in the title report prepared by security prior to the closing.
That's exactly right, and that's why this is not a title error. This was a decision made at closing to go to closing and disperse the loan proceeds without satisfying the requirement, which was to release the Brown deed of trust that had been assigned to Academy. This was a closing process and a mishandling of funds in connection with the escrow, because $1 million was paid to Mr. Morley, J.R.J. Land, the borrower, rather than to Academy Bank, which was owed the money.
And he must have known there was an error.
Oh boy, he knew it was an error. This is classic mortgage fraud. And he's the one that has a close relationship. There's evidence in the record that Norman Norris, the closer, was Mr. Morley's regular closer. He handled dozens of transactions. He was essentially flipping, if you will, subdivision lots by the blocks, by the numbers. He took the flipping of houses to a higher level and to a new scale. And yes, they were doing a very high volume. And yes, he was a very big customer. But this issue was not an underwriting decision. At trial, they tried very painfully to fit their claim into 7.1A, which says that if a title agent intentionally deletes an exception in a title commitment, that the agent may have liability if there's more than a $2 million loss. And that was what the way they tried their case was on 7.1A, not 7.2. Having lost that, they're coming up with a new theory now, having changed counsels and bringing it up for the first time in the post-trial motion. But that, so that claim was, and we went all through a trial about whether Mr. Wolf, when he looked at this thing, said, I go ahead and close, whether that was deleting an exception to a title policy. And what the court found, and appropriately so, and what we pounded on, was no amendment to the title report, no amendment to the title commitment was ever issued, saying that there was no requirement going to be made that Brown deed of trust needed to be released, or adding it as an exception and deleting it as a requirement, or anything of that sort. There was no amendment to that title report. Because we were out of the, if they had amended the title report and sent that out to Colorado East and said, is it okay, Colorado East, if we close this without paying off the senior mortgage? And if they say yes, then they amend that and remove that requirement, then that would be a different thing. That would be a title side decision by the title plant. But this was a closer who looked at it, the Brown letter, and said, well, this doesn't work. Shirley Seib testified, my practice is, on a private loan transaction like this, I get the note and deed of trust at closing. There's no payoff, so the money doesn't have to run through escrow and the whole escrow process at closing. He says, if somebody says there's no money owed and I'll produce a note and deed of trust, Shirley Seib said, I get it at closing because that's my practice, that's policy. Bo Edwards, the only expert witness who testified on this point, testified for First American. He said that is standard practice in the title business. If no money's owed and there's a requirement that a note and deed of trust be done, you get it at closing. Shirley Seib was concerned, and she said, I was very concerned. So she called Greg Wolf, and Greg Wolf said, oh, fax me the letter. And she said, okay, well, we know Brown, he's reliable, so go ahead and close. That's not an underwriting decision. That was a decision at the closing end, and it was a bad one. And it resulted in the mishandling of funds because the wrong party got paid. money that was owed to the lender, Academy Bank, got paid to the borrower, with the end result being yes.
It's your position that that's outside the agreement, or that's beyond his authority vis-a-vis your client? Do closing security title take these kinds of risks all the time?
There are certainly defalcations all the time. There's theft by closing agents. That's one way that you can have it.
I'm taking this as a conscious business decision. Okay?
On their part.
On their part. They made it.
Yes. At a time when they are not acting as an agent of First American, because we have that two hats rule. You have the title side, but when you're acting as a closing agent, you're not the agent of the underwriter. The fee, for example, only goes to the agent. It's not split with the underwriter as the title fee is. And that's standard doctrine in the title insurance business. At that point in time, they are not acting as the agent of the underwriter. They're making their own closing decision. And if they make it wrong and they pay the wrong person, it's on their dime.
Whose agent are they if they're not the agent of the
underwriter? They're an independent contractor. To the extent that they have instructions from people, and once they take money on deposit into escrow, which they did, at that point an escrow arrangement is done, and you can either say that they're a dual agent of the borrower and the...
Well, they're paid by the parties, one or both of the parties of the transaction.
That's correct.
Sat through a few of those, and some of the times it's split and sometimes not.
Yes, but it's not split with First American.
I understand. Yes. It's split between the buyer and the seller.
Yes. Yes. It was argued in the reply brief, and I wanted to point this out, that we had in our brief scoured the record, and no references to an escrow being created are in the record. In fact, there are all kinds of references in the record to the fact that this indeed was...
Well, didn't an officer of security testify it was an escrow?
Yes. Yes, it did. I just wanted to point out there's all kinds of documentary evidence. The check came in, an escrow receipt was issued, true. When the checks all went out, they all had an escrow number on them. When the order for the original title commitment came in, Exhibit 21, Norman Norris, the closer, is listed as escrow officer. In a later email she wrote on her little tag security line, she wrote the closing agent. Just to show that in the title business, the closing agent and the escrow officer are, for practical purposes, all one and the same thing. The checks that were paid to Mr. Morley, the checks that were paid off to the prior first lender, all went out as escrow checks. And the HUD 1, the closing settlement sheet, says escrow number this. An escrow was established. And as Bo Edwards said very well in his expert testimony, which is quite well worth focusing on and reading, that for practical purposes, the escrow side of the business and closing services side of the business is interchangeable terms. Escrow and closing services are interchangeable the way they use it in the title business. Indeed, the president of security testified and said that, what does your job contain as president of the company? And he says, well, I oversee sales, title, and escrow. And I asked him, what does escrow mean? He said, well, all the services that are in support of the closing and settlement of services. So even their business is set up such that there's a title side and a closing side. Again, I would underline that this was a mishandling of funds. They say repeatedly in their brief that we're trying to interpret the language of the escrow clause that this is not the handling of funds, but that's not the case at all. I think what you do have to look at.
Let me ask you a fact question.
I blew it. Actually,
the money that was distributed, whatever, 900 yes. some thousand, would that have covered the Brown deed of trust?
Would not have covered it all. There was $1.7 million due on that's $1.7 million note. So the money that was paid out to Mr. Morley was about $1.07 million. It would not have been enough to pay that.
So there's not enough money in this transaction to pay off Academy.
That's right. That's right. And if anybody had contacted Academy, they would have found that out lickety split, and this would not have closed.
Okay.
But Mr. Morley, I believe, was a persuasive individual, got the parties to close, and nothing was done after that to try to get a release from Brown or to contact Academy and say, hey, do you understand that we closed this and you're supposed to give us a release, and nobody ever made those contacts? None. There's evidence in the record that a closer called Mr. Brown and asked for a release, got no basic response, and it just went back on the shelf at Fidelity. And 2 years later, all hell broke loose because two people had been insured. I think when you look at this whole argument as to 7.2 as being a limit on damages under 7.3 and 7.4, I think that really misstates the structure of the way the contract is set out. And there are a few inconsistencies, no doubt. But 7.1 is a general rule of non-liability. The security will not have liability for title losses and so forth, except as stated herein, colon. And then there's 7.1A, 7.2, 7.3, 7.4, and 7.5. And I just wanted to point out that in their answer brief, they admit that 7.1 is the general rule of non-liability, and then there are five exceptions under which security would have liability. They're focusing on 7.2 as though it's a limiting provision, that there's a $500 damage limit for all five sections, and it's limited to $500.
What risk does it apply to?
Pardon me?
What risk does it apply to? An underwriting risk?
It applies to title errors, which come out of the title underwriting, the writing of the policy part. It comes out of title errors that are not otherwise subject to Fidelity's being liable under 7.3 and 7.4 and 7.5. 7.3 has very strong language of its own. They always repeat over and over and over again the phrase out of 7.2 that there's a $500 for a quote single loss. The only time that term single loss is a very specific defined term is used in the contract. Regardless of the cause of said loss. And they say, well, that means that damages are limited to 500 under 7.3, but the contract doesn't say that. There's five different provisions under which liability can attach, and 7.3 is a very broad one. So security shall be liable to First American for any loss with a small l or damage, terms that are broader than just the defined single loss, suffered by First American arising from any error, whether or not such loss or damage is covered by any policy of title insurance issued through or in connection with any escrow. They never say anything about that phrase, because that's a phrase that has no meaning whatsoever. If the $500 provision comes out of 7.2 and applies to all the other provisions. In fact, as the trial court pointed out, it would also render meaningless 7.4, because why have a provision saying you have to report claims and the da-da-da-da, and that there's liability if there's actual prejudice to the underwriter. Why even have that if it's limited to $500?
Is the language of the policy, the paragraph 7 generally?
Yes.
Generally used in the insurance, title insurance business? Is this standard language, or is this peculiar to your client?
A lot of this is peculiar. Most provisions are generally broad, relating to some gross negligence, relating to some fraud, relating to some liability recoveries. These are unusual provisions.
So there won't be very many, if any, cases from other jurisdictions construing these specific provisions?
That we have scoured the record for, and there really are none. Okay. This is a unique contractual setup. But I think why would a sensible corporation of First America's sign an agreement like this, believing that they would have recourse to an agent if there were errors in the handling of funds that lead to title claims, if there's delay in reporting claims, why would First American enter into something?
Well, the handling of the funds didn't lead to a title error.
Actually, it didn't lead to a title error. You're exactly right. It did lead to a loss in the claim of a policy.
I hear no other questions from the panel counsel, so thank you for your argument.
I see colors. I appreciate it.
Yes.
If it please the court, a few points in rebuttal. With respect to the fact that it was an underwriting or title side decision that led to what is characterized as a loss, certainly what was paid by First American. If we look at the testimony from Mr. Greg Wolf, who made that decision, he testified at 2834, line 14. The closer was asking me a title question because this was a title issue. He said at page 2835, I relied on this payoff and made a title insurance decision to delete this on the title commitment, and that's exactly what I did. He said, I was asked to approve the title decision as it relates to the payoff at page 2854. And of course, as Mr. Skillern said in his opening statement to the court, Security elected to accept the Brown letter as full satisfaction of its own title insurance requirement in its own commitment at page 2699. And the trial court recognized that it was a title side, title decision that Mr. Wolf made that put these events in process.
I don't recall seeing any deletion from the title commitment in connection with that testimony. Was there one?
A new document was not created. And there is no testimony that one needed to be created as such, because the matter did go forward and did close and the policy was issued.
Isn't the standard in the industry that you're not going to disperse funds until you have the requisite releases?
Well, we have things that are acceptable by statute related to payoff letters. And that is the way that Mr. Wolf treated what was received from Brown Financial, was a payoff statement that under Colorado statutes he was entitled to rely upon. Now, certainly the trial court did not believe that he was entitled to rely on that document, but it is common in the industry to have a closing occur and then things followed up with additional documentation after funds are dispersed and after the closing is concluded. I see that my time is up.
It has, counsel, and thank you to both counsel for your arguments and your briefs. We appreciate them very much.